It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We got a funding fight on our hands. Speaker Pelosi is blasting DHS's moving a total of $271 million from agencies within the department like FEMA and the Coast Guard. She says this, stealing from appropriated funds is always unacceptable, but to pick the pockets of disaster relief funding in order to fund an appalling, inhumane family incarceration plan is staggering, and to do so on the eve of hurricane season is stunningly reckless. DHS says the move increases detention beds for which they are lacking and supports the Remain in Mexico policy with the aim of moving asylum claims faster. Here's how it breaks down. You have $116 million towards single adult detention beds. Important distinction there. And $155 million towards Migrant Protection Protocols program. Democrat House members are strongly objecting to the move, saying it's totally unjustified. But former acting ICE director Ron Fotello says this is vital.
If ICE doesn't get funding for bed space, they would not be able to hold single adults. And so like most of this year, we've been releasing families at the border. And so if you don't have bed space for single adults, they either wait in custody at CBP for too long, which is not a good scenario, or they get released like the families do. And that would effectively give you an open border.
Funding is currently for 45,000 beds. They have more than 54,000 in custody. Vitella also says it's not uncommon, guys, for unassigned funds within a single department to be transferred between agencies to make up for any shortfall as the fiscal year ends, which is October.
All right, that was Griff Jenkins this morning. There's a lot more news about immigration this morning that I want to bring to you. In fact, the Pentagon has just authorized 20 additional miles of border wall. That's, 20 miles is 20 miles. We just saw that report on San Diego a couple of weeks ago, where they have reduced, because they have such a great wall between their border and Mexico, they have reduced people coming over the wall almost by 100%. And so that's what, that's what the aim is as we go further down. Of course, you hear the Democrats howling at this latest transfer of money to supply detention beds for ISIS, for ICE. And of course, ICE has become demonized, has been demonized and put in great danger by the left, by the likes of the squad in Washington, D.C. Many of them have put a target on the back of ICE officers. We've seen Antifa go after them. It's really disgraceful. But ICE is the one that enforces the immigration law inside the country. I want to just read Rachel Bovard's just a few comments that she made on a recent editorial that she wrote. She says, as Congress persists in serially ignoring anything having to do with the border crisis, the Trump administration continues to release regulations aimed at fixing the problem of illegal immigration. And then she concludes by saying, as with nearly all of our nation's immigration policies, the Trump administration has been left holding the bag as family migration surges to new highs. As Democrats and Republicans in Congress have failed even to acknowledge the problem, the Trump administration is taking necessary steps to solve a crisis that affects not only American citizens, but also thousands of migrants and migrant children put at risk. Now, she's right about that. And so you heard Griff, I mean, he was jumping out of the box talking about Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats opposing this transfer of money. And by the way, the transfer of money is just normal. It's business as usual. It's part of normal procedure in these agencies. When they have a need somewhere else, it's not what the Democrats are claiming, that it's some illegal bait and switch. It isn't. And when it gets down to this level, agencies have the freedom to do that, and it's been done several times before. Ron Vitelli, who you heard a little bit of with Griff, weighed in in another program talking about the effect of sanctuary cities. And I want you to hear what he has to say. Then I want to tell you about something that just happened this week. Let's listen.
This is a big problem. I think it's time for Montgomery County and other jurisdictions to question why or not that they're going to cooperate with ICE. You know, these are preventable crimes. These people are in the country illegally. And they, so they're across the border illegally. They overstayed their visas regardless of the circumstance. They're here in, against the law. And then they go on to commit another crime. And like these crimes, very disturbing situation that's going on in Montgomery County. Last month, the county executive issued an executive order basically, you know, saying that they're not going to work with ICE to help remove these people from their community. They should change it. It would make their community safer. They would protect their citizens better.
All right. So what he's referring to is Montgomery County, Maryland, which has become a hotbed for MS-13 and other illegal immigrants. They are overwhelmed by illegal immigrants. And so just in this past few days, there has been a fifth case of an illegal immigrant raping a girl, this time a 16-year-old girl, climbing through her window and forcing her. And it's more than that. There are sordid, horrible details about what he did to her. She's 16 years old. He is Nelson Reyes Medrano. He's an undocumented immigrant living in Germantown, Maryland. He's got 10 children. He's married with 10 children, and I think half of those children are under the age of 6. He used a knife on this girl. And again, this is the fifth case in Montgomery County in, I'm not sure the time span, but it's not over a long period of time. And the reason, by the way, he's from El Salvador, and they are swarming with El Salvadorians in Montgomery County, many of them illegal immigrants. And this is a word from Daniel Horowitz with Conservative Review. He says, thanks to the terrific and rare act of journalism performed by local ABC reporter Kevin Lewis, four previous cases of illegal aliens arrested for rape in the Maryland Sanctuary County have come to light this month. If not for his reporting, we would likely never know about these cases. And then he says sanctuary cities either serve as a magnet for sex offenders or sometimes even release them in defiance of federal immigration law. That's a big story. He said if there was a Kevin Lewis in every major media outlet, the country would learn the true extent of the sex offender problem and the danger of sanctuary cities. As Lewis notes, Montgomery County, like most jurisdictions, refuses to collect data on the number of rapes or other criminal crimes committed by illegal immigrants, so there is no way to quantify how often this happens. And so so now they have issued a retainer, or I think that's the title of it, on this particular illegal immigrant who's now in custody. But the problem is, of course, Montgomery County is ignoring federal law. They are ignoring federal law, refusing to cooperate with ICE. And so can you imagine living? I have a good friend that lives in Germantown. Can you imagine having this happen in your community? And again, these are just the things we know about. As Daniel says, this is one reporter and he works for ABC. I wonder how much longer, honestly, he'll be working for ABC given what's going on. And back to the border. And the fact that they've just transferred more money for ICE beds, and the fact that the Pentagon is going to be releasing the funds to build 20 more miles, a border wall. I just got this from Federation for American Immigration Reform just as I was going on the air, so let me read it to you. Confidential sources inside the Border Patrol have told FAIR that illegal alien apprehensions will likely drop dramatically for the month of August, with a monthly total projected to be 40 to 50,000 in range. To put this in perspective, this would be roughly 100,000 fewer apprehensions than we had in May, and the third month in a row that apprehension numbers have decreased. The big question is whether these numbers are a blip on the screen or the result of deterrence from several Trump administration initiatives. And let me remind you what those are. And keep in mind what Rachel said and what I tell you all the time, that the Congress is doing nothing. Nothing, nothing. No money for the border wall, nothing to change the laws. It's just a disgrace. And you must remember that because we're coming up to an election and your congressman and whoever officials in your state, your county, need to be held accountable for how they are handling the out-of-control illegal immigration that we're experiencing in this country. It's not just at the border. It's in Montgomery County, for heaven's sake, Maryland. It's a long way from the border. This is an issue for all of our states because thousands and hundreds of thousands, you could argue, of illegal immigrants have been bused to the interior of the country. And it is definitely changing. I guess color-wise, of course, there are more brown people, but that's really not the point. The point is the kinds of people, the values the standards of living, the ability to work and contribute to the community economically and not drain our resources. That's really the issue. So let me read to you. Let me just remind you what President Trump has done all by himself, because the Congress is derelict in their duties. He got Mexico to do a better job of monitoring illegal entry over its southern border. Remember, they brought out troops. And then he also started a program called Migrant Protection Protocol, which mandates asylum seekers be detained in Mexico until their case can be heard in the U.S. That's another thing that, took place. The Guatemala Agreement mandated that asylum applicants have to seek asylum in Guatemala. That Guatemala needs to enforce this. That's basically international law, but it hasn't been. It's just been totally ignored. So they've been marching through these countries without any kind of unfettered and unstopped to get asylum in the United States, and that's not the way the international asylum protocols work. You seek asylum in the country that you go through first, as long as it's not, you know, a country you need to be that is dangerous to you as well. And then the Flores rule, which is the one that was used to excuse letting illegal immigrant families out into the country in droves because they could not be held together in detention facilities. They could not be held more than 20 days. And so this was the whole rule that was passed a long time before President Trump ever got in place. The rule made it impossible to remove if you didn't want the children to be separated from their parents, you had to release them all into the country. Either that or you separated the children from their parents because kids can't go to jail with parents. It's just that way kind of everywhere. And so they have done away with the Flores rule and are now holding families together in other kinds of facilities. But here's the thing. This has been a ruling that has allowed so many of the cartels and other nefarious characters to traffic children. And the children have been trafficked sometimes even more than once, two, three times across that long trek with members of cartels to present themselves as so-called family. It's disgraceful. It's disgraceful. And Congress, while Congress has done nothing, that's what President Trump has done. And so we see the effects of it, and we should be grateful. I'm certainly grateful. Let me give you a few more pieces of news that I can mention, just some interesting things. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been ill again. She's being treated for pancreatic cancer, and she just appeared at an event and this past week. She at the University of Buffalo. She looked good. She looked weak, I have to say, but you know, no one knows exactly. Certainly, she can't live forever because she's not young. No one rejoices in this, but what happens is if something should happen to her that she has to step aside, a 2020 court vacancy would be amazing because we're coming up on 2020. And Mitch McConnell has already said that he will proceed to get a Trump appointee, a nominee, into that position. So it just, you know, Kate, brace yourselves because you could imagine what kind of a reaction there's going to be from the left, because if Ruth Bader Ginsburg should step aside, and he, you know, we already have a long list of candidates, courtesy of the Federalist Society and others that have created really strong lists of conservatives for President Trump. They're ready, waiting in the wings. And so if something should happen to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that would happen. And you can imagine the fight. We saw what happened with Brett Kavanaugh, and you can only imagine that will be repeated. There's so many more little things to tell you. Honestly, it's interesting. This is the slowest news cycle I've seen in a very long time. It's because it's the end of summer. Congress is out, not able to do their nefarious, bad business. And a lot of news people are on vacation, you know, getting ready, gearing up for the fall when Congress gets back in session. And so it's kind of a quiet time. But still, there's news. I'm going to bring you a lot of interesting stories. But I'm kind of grateful. It's kind of a breather. Interesting breather. So anyway, stay tuned because lots of interesting things nevertheless. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The 2019 Values Voter Summit is coming October 11th through the 13th to Washington, D.C. The summit will help inform and mobilize citizens across America to preserve the bedrock values that help make our nation strong. The event will include a luncheon by AFA Action and speakers like National Security Advisor John Bolton, Franklin Graham, conservative host Laura Ingraham, and Senator Lindsey Graham. Here's AFA public policy analyst Abraham Hamilton III.
My hopes are that the people who attend will be fortified, they will be inspired, they will be equipped to carry the fire of Christ following into their civic engagement responsibilities.
Register and get more information at valuesvotersummit.org. That's valuesvotersummit.org. Don't miss the 2019 Values Voter Summit, October 11th through the 13th in Washington, D.C., co-sponsored by AFA Action.
This is Pause to Pray, a chance each day to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today, we pray for David Bernhardt, Secretary of the Interior. His department is responsible for the management and conservation of federal land and natural resources. Genesis 1:1 reminds us that all the earth is God's creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask for guidance for David Bernhardt as he oversees the care and use of federal land. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team. Volume 4 of our daily prayer journal is now available. To receive your copy, go to pausetopray.org.
Fox News Commentary with Todd Starnes.
A change in values. That story coming up.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Blake Bramlett. I graduated in May of 2016, and I graduated with a degree in interdisciplinary studies, focusing in psychology and missions. The professors here at TMU have really impacted my life in more than one way. In the classroom, of course, but really honestly, what makes the experience at Truett better is that they're mentors to us.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
A new survey conducted by the Wall Street Journal and NBC News indicates a major shift in American values. The survey found millennials are not as patriotic or as religious or as family-oriented as Americans were 20 years ago. The Wall Street Journal says millennials and Generation Zers care less about God and country than Generation X. 80% of Americans 55 or older say patriotism is important, compared to 42% of younger Americans. I wish I could tell you I was surprised by the findings, but I'm not. My new book, Culture Jihad, explores the radical shift in our culture on issues like faith and freedom. I'm afraid what we are seeing is the impact of left-wing ideology from within our public school systems. As a matter of fact, many of our classrooms have marginalized faith and family and freedom, which is why we are seeing a growing number of young Americans embrace socialism. I'm Todd Starnes.
That's your Fox News commentary.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Johnson & Johnson's misleading marketing and promotion of opioids created a nuisance.
Johnson & Johnson did not cause the opioid abuse crisis here in Oklahoma or anywhere in this country. We have many strong grounds for appeal, and we intend to pursue those vigorously.
I'm asking the CEO of that company to get his checkbook out and write this check so that we can start, again, addressing the problems they created in our state.
Yes, that was just a montage of the prosecutor and also the judge and the defender of the Johnson & Johnson, who manufactures one of the opioids. Now, opioids, of course, have become a horrible crisis in this country. There's just no doubt about it. I can't, honestly, who of you does not know someone whose life has been a child or an adult who's been affected by some sort of addiction to opioids? And we hear nightmare scenarios about what's happening to the kids. But I have to say, I have a problem with this lawsuit. I mean, the judge awarded Attorney General of Oklahoma a huge amount of money that Johnson & Johnson is supposed to hand over. And supposedly, you know, Johnson & Johnson, Johnson for manufacturing that particular opioid is responsible for the addictions. You know, I'm just not a fan of that. I just don't understand that. I don't think that gun manufacturers are responsible for people killing people with guns. You know, I don't think that, you know, food manufacturers are responsible for you and me being fat. And I really never thought that cigarette companies were responsible for people being addicted, unless they did false advertising, which I think was part of the deal, but part of the settlement. But I just don't know how we ever got to this lack of personal responsibility. You know, opioids have a wonderful use, and they have made life bearable for so many people who are in terrible pain from a number of reasons, after surgeries or because of arthritis or chronic conditions, some kind of pains. There was a young girl that used to sign for me when I was a singer who was in chronic, horrible pain. She was just the most beautiful girl, but she could hardly do her life because of all her pain. And so there are uses for these things. And according to, you know, I don't know anything about Johnson & Johnson's practices. I'm not an expert on this case. I'm talking to you in broad terms. But Johnson & Johnson claims that they were following the guidelines of the FDA. They made the medicine available to doctors to prescribe it. What about doctors? You know, if doctors are overprescribing, then that's a problem, and that needs to be addressed. But if people are, you know, getting drugs illegally or are, you know, asking for pain medications when they don't need them, then I think they're kind of responsible for that too, don't you? So I want to give you a statement from the Independent Women's Forum because I think they're right about this. This is a little different angle to it, but I totally agree with them. Today's verdict by Judge Thad Bachman that Johnson & Johnson must pay the operating costs of Oklahoma state government as penance for the opioid crisis puts manufacturers of a lawful but politically unpopular product at risk. Sadly, most people today know of someone who has grappled with opioid addiction, but lawsuits brought by publicity-seeking politicians won't solve the problem. The verdict is a victory for taxation by litigation, but it is consumers who will pay the price in the form of higher prices and reduced access to pain medications for patients who need them. And that's really the truth. That's what's going to happen here. And I went on the coverage of it last night. I couldn't, how could you miss that they just jump automatically, they tell the story, and they move automatically to telling the tragedies of opioid addiction. And it is a tragedy, but I just don't think you can tie the two together. So because we have this tragedy happening in Oklahoma and other states, we're going to, you know, make the drug manufacturers who are making it for people who really need it, and it's being abused by people who don't really need it, they're responsible? I don't see that. And it's a terrible precedent that we're going to see. And you can imagine it's going to be going to apply. If it stands in higher courts, it will be applied to places like gun manufacturers and, you know, who knows, food products. You know, potato chips make you fat. So let's sue the potato chip companies. It's certainly not your fault that you eat too many of them. And you see what I mean? It's just... I don't like that. I think it's a very bad trajectory. All right, what's happening on the campaign trail? You know, I could talk about Joe Biden. Honestly, my mind just phases. I don't. There's so much news about the Democratic candidates, and certainly we need to keep our eye to it and our ear to it. Today is the day that if they're going to be in the next debate, they have to have reached 2% and an average of 3 polls, and they have to have certain fundraising goals met as well. I think there's probably 10 who are still standing, at least as the day started. We'll see what happens by the end of the day. But this really caught my eye, my ear. This was Bernie Sanders, and the reason it caught my ear is because Bernie's a communist. Bernie spent his honeymoon in Moscow when Russia was our enemy. Bernie has waxed eloquently about the communist Sandinistas in Central America. He's bragged on the Soviet Union and their method of doing government and business. And the fact that he's a presidential candidate really kind of stuns me. So when he talks about universal health care for everyone, he's talking about, you know, that's what the left wants because it's a way to control you. So just keep that in mind. But this is what he had to say about China. Interestingly enough, the last part of what Bernie said about China, I agree. He talks about trade deals being crafted by very large corporations who want cheap labor. That's true, and that's why I have a problem. That's why our country's lost manufacturing. That is actually true. But the first part of his statement is what I want to draw your attention to. Here it is.
I think China is a country that is moving, unfortunately, in a more authoritarian way in a number of directions. We would have hoped that they would move toward a democratic, more democratic form of government and moving in the opposite direction. And they are a country that vigorously protects their own interests. But what we have to say about China, in fairness to China and its leadership, is if I'm not mistaken, they have made more progress in addressing extreme poverty than any country in the history of civilization.
Okay. Okay, so let me just talk about that for a second, that China has made more advance in extinguishing extreme poverty than any other nation in history. Really? Honestly, I have been to China so many times and traveled not just in the cities, but in the rural areas. They are a third world country. The people live in poverty. What he just said is absolutely not true. I'm sure that many Chinese have been lifted out of poverty because of the generous gift of our secrets, our manufacturing and everything to the Chinese people. The transfer of wealth from this country to China is stunning. We are the reason that they have the second largest economy because of our feckless leadership. Meanwhile, it's true, Bernie Sanders is right, that major corporations made out like a bandit while they got cheap labor. And so that's what's been happening. And the Chinese have profited from that. But they've not pulled out of extreme poverty. And just to reiterate, I believe I told you this yesterday, there was a study on taking on the New York Times about their claim that there are more poor, percentage-wise, there are more poor people in America than there are in Mexico. And then they named other countries as well. But here's the fact. The facts are that 20% of Americans are considered in poverty by our standards. And the fact is, according to the research we talked about yesterday, if you took those 20% who live in poverty and formed a country, they would still be the richest country in the world. Because our poor are not poor by Chinese standards. Our poor are not poor by Mexican standards. It's a completely warped statement to say that China has done more to alleviate poverty than any country. I would say America probably stands tall easily. I can't think of a country that has eliminated poverty the same way. We have, between our social programs, food stamps, all the things that we do, it's an amazing thing. So American poor are not, I'm not saying no one in America is poor. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the poor in this country still buy. In fact, one of the stats yesterday was that the poorest people in our country still buy and consume more than average citizens in Europe. So so Bernie's a liar. And when he talks about that China needs a more democratic government, really? He likes democracy? Really? He certainly likes to get wealthy in a free society, but his love of the Soviet Union and of the communists in Central America do not demonstrate that he is any fan of democracy. And it reminds me of a story that I read, long piece actually, from the New York Times a couple of days ago, about a guy named Sidney Rittenberg. And here's the headline: Sidney Rittenberg, idealistic American. There's a word missing. Someone who supported Mao, who evolved into a capitalist at the age of 98. Okay, so this guy, Sidney, was in World War II. He actually was a soldier. I don't know what capacity. He was an American soldier. And as soon as the war was over, he goes to China because he loves Mao. He's a communist, Sidney Rittenberg. And he goes and he works. He's really close to Mao. He's close to Mao's family. He's close to all the people there. And so, you know, he was there when they were purging and killing people, and he was fine with that because he loved communism. He's from a prominent Charleston, South Carolina family. He joined the Communist Party. He arrived in China as an army private just as World War II ended. Fluent in Chinese, he was committed to Marxist-Leninist ideals. For most of his time in China, from 45 to 1980, he was an intimate of the Communist Party's top leaders, whom he sought out in their mountain sanctuary. It's a long story about it. It's an interesting story, but he gets very close to them, and he helps them in every way he can. And then he ends up on the short end of the straw because Mao's wife got mad at him. So he went to prison for, I think, 6 years in solitary confinement. But that didn't dissuade him. He came out, and he got involved again, and he was the director of Radio Beijing. He helped them with their propaganda. But then, lo and behold, he decided to come back to the United States in 1977, and Jimmy Carter let him back in. And guess what? He goes to move to Arizona, and he becomes a multi-millionaire because he helped technology companies. He helped Levi Strauss, Prudential Insurance, Polaroid, Microsoft, Intel make inroads in China to make money. And so he became a very wealthy man at the end of his life. And so this is how this goes. And I say that reminded me of Bernie Sanders, this American GI who loves communism, loved it, and ended up being very wealthy because of his capitalist instincts. He kind of liked money. And I think Bernie's kind of the same way. Bernie has three homes. He's a millionaire, and he loves communism for others, maybe not for himself. All right, Joe Walsh is kind of new on the scene. Oh, now I guess I should go to this. Beto O'Rourke then also is out on the campaign trail. He said something yesterday that was pretty stunning, or at least in the last 2 days, and I thought you might want to hear it. Beto O'Rourke.
With the people of Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, reduce violence in their home communities. Violence which we are somewhat to blame for, the civil wars that we've been involved in, the drug trade that we facilitated, the war on drugs that has militarized and hollowed out their civic institutions in their home countries. And Guatemala, suffering one of the greatest droughts in their recorded history, caused not by God nor by Mother Nature, but by you and me and all of us in our omissions and our excesses and our inaction in the face of the facts and the science and the truth.
Okay, so you and I are responsible for the problems in Central America because of the war on drugs. We're also responsible for the drought in Guatemala because we're not handling climate change, and that would affect them, and we could have stopped that drought if we'd done more. It wasn't God, it was us. So you and I are to blame, which reminds me of that story I told you yesterday about Barack and Michelle Obama buying that $15 million house, 7,000 square feet on Martha's Vineyard. And we talked about the hypocrisy of the left coming after businesses, telling them you didn't build that, the resentment that they stoke about big business and moneyed people. And, you know, and that's then they get rich because that's what they like to do. It's for you, not for them. But ironically, many now are pointing out that the site of that new mansion on Martha's Vineyard, according to Climate Central, which is the research, I think it's CNN who uses this. It's based off the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's extreme rise scenario. It's Climate Central, and they are the go-to, I think, for the New York Times or for CNN or both. So, but their model shows that, well, in fact, President Obama's mansion, if the sale goes through, will be underwater by 2010. So, and it goes in great detail about this. In many coastal states, flood-prone areas have seen the highest rates of home construction since 2010. A study found suggesting that the risks of climate change have yet to fundamentally change people's behavior. That was the New York Times who uses Climate Central. So now we know that Barack and Michelle Obama, who totally embrace climate change, at least they tell you they do, they're buying a mansion that will probably be underwater based on the people that they allegedly trust. They don't really believe it. It's all a matter of, again, controlling and managing us. By the way, CNN is scheduling a 7-hour climate town hall for the 2020 candidates. 7 hours of climate, and they're each going to talk for, I don't know, 40 minutes, something like that. It's, yeah, so, yeah, I don't think I'll be tuning in for that one, but maybe you will be. It reminds me of that empty chair at that climate a conference at the G7 where President Trump wasn't there. All the leaders were there, and then there's this empty chair, big old empty chair, because President Trump didn't bother to go because he thinks it's nonsense and a hoax. And, yep, so do I. And I think Obama must, too, or he wouldn't be buying that house, you think? Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
What is the source of America's greatness? My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Alexis de Tocqueville, a 19th century French political thinker and philosopher, had this exact same question. On the heels of the French Revolution, he came to America in 1831 to investigate America's ascendancy. In doing so, he found that America's greatness did not lie in her economic system. It did not lie in her banking system, nor did it lie in her educational system. He found America's pulpits aflamed with righteousness was the source of America's greatness. He opined that America is great because she is good. But when America ceases to be good, she will cease to be great. Let us pray for a restoration of the flame of righteousness in our pulpits.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian will tell us what he's interested in, and Brian's interested in about everything. There's not a story out there that he does not see through a biblical lens. It's not finding content for the program. It's finding which content would be best for that day.
Focal Point with Brian Fisher, weekdays at 1 Central on AFR.
Brian walks into the studio with a stack of papers ready to tackle the issues of the day.
Hey, Target. You thought we were done?
Did you think we would give up?
Well, of course not. We still stand strong with our belief that men do not belong in the women's restrooms or changing areas. It's absurd. We should not have to walk in your restrooms with the fear of someone of the opposite sex walking in on us.
Together, we will stop this open door policy.
Help us by signing the pledge to boycott Target at afa.net.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. Americanism is formed around certain fundamental values, including love of country, faith in God, and strong families. According to a poll conducted by the Wall Street Journal and NBC News, the commitment of the millennial generation to patriotism has dropped 9% in the last 20 years, support for religious faith has dropped 12%, and the importance of having children has fallen a whopping 16%. These are alarming trends. Christian faith is the source of America's character and greatness. Love of country leads young men to wear the uniform, and having young families gives them something to fight for. Dads, it's our job to instill these values in our sons. I've written the Boy to Man book for every father of every 12-year-old boy in America to mentor their sons to mature manhood. Order your copy today at afastore.net.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. One of President Trump's most important initiatives is the executive order he issued in March to protect our nation's critical infrastructure against electromagnetic pulse. Our enemies know they can currently use EMP to take down the electric grid and our country, which depends critically upon it. And Mother Nature's solar storms will if they don't. A congressionally mandated Blue Ribbon Commission has documented these facts for 18 years, yet EMP deniers in the electric industry and successive administrations have long relied on wishful thinking and junk science to justify their refusal to take corrective action, leaving us acutely vulnerable to nation-ending catastrophe. Yesterday, the Air Force Electromagnetic Defense Task Force thoroughly debunked their latest pretext, a seriously defective and highly misleading study paid for by the recalcitrant utilities. So now, let's get on with securing the grid. This is Frank Affney. Learn more at securethegrid.com.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
And speaking of Beto O'Rourke, speaking of Beto, Sandy Rios back with you. He was at a campaign event at Benedict College in Columbia, South Carolina on Tuesday. And Breitbart News editor, senior editor, Joel Pollack, and I happen to sometimes I mean, you probably think I know everyone. I really don't, but I do know Joel pretty well. I knew Joel. This is really a sidebar. Joel is an Orthodox Jew. He was a very young man when he ran against Jan Schakowsky in Chicago. Jan is a hardcore leftist. And Joel took her on in a race, and that's how I got to know him. That was a long time ago. It's before he was even ever married. But he was wonderful. I mean, he was just delightful, just brilliant. He didn't really think at the time he could win, but he really put a dent, you know, he really took her on. And so he was pretty remarkable. I enjoyed meeting him and I enjoyed getting to know his wife then later. And he's a senior editor now at Breitbart. But here's the thing. Joel was at O'Rourke's event at Columbia, South Carolina on Tuesday, and he was kicked out. So this is what happened. The reporter asked a question during a press gaggle on Monday evening that was the only interaction of any kind with candidate Beto O'Rourke. The question asked the Democratic presidential hopeful whether misquoting Trump's comments on riots in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017 was consistent with O'Rourke's pledge to heal and not inflame divisions in this country. So that's what Joel asked. But then in the hallway at Benedict, Stephen, who was a staffer for O'Rourke, threatened Joel, saying he could either leave voluntarily or be officially uninvited from campus. So Joel left with a police officer. And interestingly enough, looking back on this, Beto O'Rourke tweeted just last year, "The press is not the enemy of the people, but the best defense against tyranny." That's one of the ironies. So I just wanted to bring a few stories to you about what's happening on the campaign trail. One more. Joe Walsh. Joe pitched his hat into the ring. Joe is a congressman from Chicago, well, Chicago area, who I also know. Joe ran for Congress, I think, when I was still living in Chicago. I think I get my timelines mixed up, but Joe was a Tea Party candidate, and he was very outspoken, kind of a maverick, and I really liked him and supported him. He served one term in Congress, and because of his outspokenness, he did not get reelected. And so I've always really liked Joe and respected so. Then he went on the air at my former network in Chicago, which is Salem, and he's been doing talk radio there now for some time. Now, he just said earlier this week he's going to run for president, and this is how he launched his campaign. Let's listen.
If Republicans, John, stay silent in the face of this guy, I don't think the country will ever forgive the Republican Party, but forget about the Republican Party. If this guy gets four more years, we're in real, real trouble. We've got a guy in the White House who's unfit, completely unfit, to be president. And it stuns me that nobody stepped up. Nobody in the Republican Party stepped up, because I'll tell you what, George, everybody believes in the Republican Party. Everybody believes that he's unfit. He lies every time he opens his mouth. The president of the United States is tweeting us into a recession. You can't believe a word he says. And again, I don't care your politics. That should concern you. He's nuts. He's erratic. He's cruel. He stokes bigotry. He's incompetent. He doesn't know what he's doing. George, he's a narcissist. Everything he cares about, the only thing he cares about, is Trump. He doesn't give a about America. He doesn't care about the border. I'm going to pound Trump every single day. He's a bully and he's a coward, and somebody has to call him out. We have a guy in the White House who's never apologized for anything he's done or said. He's not capable of being decent. He's cruel. He's bigoted. And he's a narcissist. Everything is about him.
Okay, so there's Joe Walsh, former congressman from Illinois, talk show host in Chicago on the Salem Network. Well, I don't know what happened to Joe. I don't see it like he sees it. And I guess Salem didn't see it like he saw it either, because he's lost his job now that he's come out swinging. And the irony is, he did an interview with CNN with another talk. Could they love him? You know, right now they love him because he's a Republican saying all these things about the president. The irony is, a CNN anchor brought up to Joe all the things that he has said in the past and all the tweets. And Joe is careless, and he said a lot of things that are, you know, like a talk show host says. And so so he said, "You think these things you've said should be brought up and held against you, and the things you've tweeted and said? Oh, well, you know, I believe in free speech, et cetera, et cetera." So the problem is that Joe, of course, lives in a glass house based on all the things that he has said. It's just pretty much the pot calling the kettle black, and I don't think Joe's going to be able to prevail unless he gets a sugar daddy that's willing to waste some money. But it's still sad. It's sad to me. It's sad to see someone. I just don't even know what he was thinking. How did he ever think that he could run for president, even? I mean, that I don't get that. I don't get it for a lot of people, why they suddenly think Kirsten Gillibrand, for instance, the Valley Girl, the official Valley Girl, what in the world makes her think she could run for president? What I don't, some people have the qualifications. I always maintain that the people that are the most reluctant are the most qualified. That's kind of really the way I feel about it, whether it's, you know, president of the school board or whatever. But it doesn't, you know, usually it doesn't happen. It's the people that self-promote that find themselves in positions. But anyway, that's Joe Walsh. I wanted you to know my thoughts about him for what that's worth. Okay, so earlier in the week, we played a series of clips on others on the left assessing President Trump's nature, behavior, whatever you call it. Brett Stevens of the New York Times was one of those, and I want you to listen to it before I tell you a story about Brett. Let's listen.
The real issue for Republicans is simply to call out the fact that the president does not stand in any way for the traditional conservative economic principles that have defined the party for the better part of the last 70 years. They don't even stand, never mind the economic principles, broader principles of character. I mean, what we saw over the last few days is a president who is either mentally unwell or morally unfit. Maybe both. I don't know. But it's important to simply call these things as we see them. You have behavior that is unprecedented in any kind of presidential history in the United States or frankly elsewhere. So when I hear guys like Eric say, well, you know, this is at the end of the day, this is a choice. You know, I'd actually rather have a candidate on the Democratic side who at least doesn't scare me every single morning.
All right, so that's Brett Stevens. I just wanted you to remember who he is. Now, here's the story. A professor at George Washington University, he's an associate professor, took on Brett Stevens over a column that he wrote or something that he said. And basically, okay, here's what he said. This, okay, the professor's name is Dave Karp. So here's a report from Fox News, and this is how it says, that Karp had some fun at the expense of Brett Stevens on Monday when he suggested that the bed bugs that had reportedly infested the Times newsroom last weekend, and that was a story in the news, were a metaphor, and the bed bugs are Brett Stevens. So, okay, you got that? They reported that there's bed bugs at the New York Times, and this assistant professor this associate professor says, oh, it's a metaphor. The bed bugs are Brett Stevens. And so here's what happened. Brett Stevens got very upset about that and wrote the professor back. And he says, someone just pointed out a tweet you wrote about me calling me a bed bug. I'm often amazed about the things supposedly decent people are prepared to say about other people, people they've never met on Twitter. I think you've set a new standard. And so he goes on to say, I would welcome this is Stevens writing, Brett Stevens. I would welcome the opportunity for you to come to my home, meet my wife and kids, talk to us for a few minutes, and then call me a bed bug to my face. That would take some genuine courage and intellectual integrity on your part. I promise to be courteous no matter what you have to say. Maybe it will make you feel better about yourself. Please consider this a standing invitation. You are more than welcome to bring your significant other. Okay, so all right, so you say, well, the guy shouldn't have called him a bedbug, but the professor wrote an op-ed, which is worth considering, and I want to read a bit of it to you. He said, Brett Stevens is above me in the status hierarchy. He knows this. I know this. He has won a Pulitzer Prize and has a regular op-ed column in the New York Times. I'm just some professor. So I was surprised to receive an email from Brett Stevens last night. He says, meanwhile, I was surprised that he found the tweet at all. I had not used his Twitter handle in the message with zero retweets. He would have had to look hard to find it on Twitter and would have had to work even harder to take offense at such an innocuous joke. But what was most striking to me was that he had gone to the effort to copy the provost of George Washington University, including the provost clarifies the intent of the message. In other words, Brett is trying to get this professor in trouble. It means he was not reaching out in earnest attempt to promote online civil discourse. It means he was trying to send a message that he stands above me in the status hierarchy and that people like me are not supposed to write mean jokes about people like him. It was an exercise in wielding power, using the imprimatur of the New York Times to ward off speech that he finds distasteful. You can draw your own conclusions as to whether my joke was worth a chuckle, but equating a random Twitter account with a totalitarian regime is a remarkably long walk, and he's saying that because Brett then on MSNBC said that being called a bedbug is a tactic that traces back to totalitarian regimes. So this is just a professor on a tweet that was not retweeted, that was not, they didn't use Brett's Twitter handle. Brett had to look hard to find this tweet. It hasn't gotten a lot of play. He's going on television saying that he's being called a bedbug and this is what totalitarian regimes do, but it's just his professor who said that. And so Brett Stevens seems to think his social status should render him immune from criticism from people like me. I think that the rewards of his social status come with an understanding that lesser-known people will say mean things about him online. Stevens reached out to me in the mistaken belief that I would feel ashamed. He reached out believing my university would chastise me for provoking the ire of a writer at the New York Times. That's an abuse of his social station. It cost me nothing, but it is an abuse of his power that would carry a real penalty for a younger or less privileged academic. And then he says the Times should expect more of its writers. There's more to it, but I just, you get the gist of it. Very interesting. And then that takes me to another story. The Washington Post published this really bizarre editorial smearing pro-lifers as racists. And it was written by Marisa Brostoff. And basically she says that J.D. Vance, who's was speaking at... He was speaking at some conservative National Conservatism Conference last month. This is what she wrote, that he said, our people aren't having enough children to replace themselves. That should bother us. J.D. Vance, author of the best-selling Hillbilly Elegy, told his audience at the National Conservatism Conference last week. Earlier this year, he described himself as appalled by Democrats' permissive attitudes toward abortion. Vance did not spell out exactly who is included in the word our. He didn't need to. So she goes on to claim that he's talking about white people. It turns out that she is completely lifting his words out of context. Vance was speaking about the birth rate of the entire country. This is what he said leading up to it. There are a lot of ways to measure a healthy society, but the most important way to measure a healthy society is by whether a nation is having enough children to replace itself. Do people look to the future and see a place worth having children in? Do they have economic prospects and expectations that they're going to be able to put a good roof over that kid's head, food on the table, and provide that child with a good education? By every statistic that we have, people are answering no to all of those questions. And that's when he goes on to say, we're not having enough children to replace ourselves. And she's claiming he's talking about white people. But in the course of his broader address, he encouraged the support of African-American single moms. And so it was a complete lie. Brostoff, Marisa, the one that wrote that, tweeted in response, "Welp, the J.D. Vance stands freaked out. The Washington Post bad enough that they pulled a line suggesting he was worried about declining white birth rates and confirmed that he was really talking about declining American birth rates, a very non-white nationalist thing to be worried about." You see how this goes. And so, by the way, a group of Trump conservatives, pro-Trump conservatives, are doing background on journalists and finding out stuff about them that maybe the public should know. I remember that horrible story about Don Lemon just 2 weeks ago. I couldn't even tell you because it was so vulgar. And then Chris Cuomo with his threatening the guy at the gym for calling him, what, Fredo? Just amazing. Almost got in a fight. And these are the things we probably should know about journalists, sort of to help us to understand where they're coming from, as though we didn't already know. All right, there's that non-news day, I promise. Okay, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.